hadn't been worth a damn in saving the poor bastard's life. They had identified the cause of death, though, and it hadn't resulted from a street hood. "Think they lost any sleep over that incident?" "I do not," C assured him. "Looks bad. They don't do much of this anymore. Not that I've heard about. Only at home, I grant you that. But Poland is home for them, well within their sphere of influence. But the Pope lives in Rome, and that isn't. It comes down to how scared they are, sir. Father Tim Riley at Georgetown, back when I got my doctorate, he said never to forget that wars are begun by frightened men. They fear war, but more than that, they fear what will happen if they don't start one. Or take equivalent action, I suppose. So, the real question is, as I said, how seriously they will take the threat and how serious it will appear to them. On the former, yes, I don't think this is a bluff. The Pope's character, background, and personal courage, those are not things to be doubted. So the threat is a real one. The larger question is how to evaluate the magnitude of the threat to them. Go on, the Director General ordered gently. If they're smart enough to recognize it... Yes, sir, in their position, I'd be concerned about it. Maybe even a little frightened. As much as the Soviets think they're a superpower, America's equal and all that, deep down they know that their state is not really legitimate. Kissinger gave a lecture to us at Georgetown. Jack leaned back and closed his eyes for a moment to recapture the performance. It was something he said near the end, talking about the character of the Russian leaders. Brezhnev was showing him around some official building or other in the Kremlin where Nixon was going to come for his last summit meeting. He was lifting cloth covers off the statuary, showing how they'd taken the time to clean everything up in preparation for the visit. Why do that? I wondered at the time. I mean, sure, they have maids and maintenance people. Why make a point of showing it to Henry? It has to be a sense of inferiority, fundamental insecurity. We keep hearing that they're 10 feet tall, but I don't think so. And the more I learn about them, the less formidable I think they are. The Admiral and I have argued this one back and forth for the last couple of months. They have a large military. Their intelligence services are first rate. They are big. Big ugly bear, like Muhammad Ali used to say. But you know, Ali beat the bear twice, didn't he? That's a roundabout way of saying that, yes, sir, I think this letter will scare them. Question is, scare them enough to do something? Ryan shook his head. Possibly, yes, but we have insufficient data at this time. If they decide to push that particular button, will we know beforehand? Charleston had been waiting for Ryan to turn the tables on him. One can hope so, but it's impossible to be sure. In the year I've been at Langley, the impression I get is that our knowledge of the target is deep, but narrow in some areas, shallow and broad in others. I've yet to meet somebody who feels comfortable analyzing them. Well, that's not exactly true. Some are comfortable, but their analyses are often, to me at least, unreliable. Like the stuff we get on their economy. James lets you into that? Basil was surprised. The Admiral sent me all around the barn the first couple of months. My first degree was economics from Boston College. I passed my CPA exam before I went away with the Marine Corps. A certified public accountant. You call it something different over here. Then after I left the Corps, I did okay in the stock and bond business before I finished up my doctorate and went into teaching. Exactly how much did you make on Wall Street? While I was at Merrill Lynch? Oh, between 6 and 7 million. A lot of that was the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. My Uncle Mario, my mom's brother, told me that the employees were going to buy out the stock and try to get the railroad profitable again. I took a look at it and liked what I saw. It paid off a net of 23-1 on my investment. I ought to have dropped more into it, but they taught me to be conservative at Merrill Lynch. Never worked in New York, by the way. I was in the Baltimore office. Anyway, the money's still in stocks. The market looks pretty healthy at the moment. I still dabble in it. You never know when you're going to stumble across a winner, and it's still an interesting hobby. Indeed. If you see anything promising, do let me know. No fees. But no guarantees either, Ryan joked. I'm not accustomed to those, Jack, not in this bloody business. I'm going to assign to you our Russian working group with Simon Harding. Oxford graduate, doctorate in Russian literature. You will see just about everything he sees. Everything but source information. Ryan stopped him with two raised hands. Sir Basil, I do not want to know that stuff. I don't need it, and knowing it would keep me awake at night. Just so I see the raw. I prefer to do my own analysis. This Harding guy is smart? Ryan asked with deliberate artlessness. Very much so. You've probably seen his product before. He did the personal evaluation on Yuri Andropov, we turned out, 2 years ago. I did read that. Yeah, that was good work. I figured he was a shrink. He's read psychology, but not quite enough for a degree. Simon's a clever lad. Wife is an artist, painter, lovely lady. Right now? Why not? I must get back to my work. Come, I'll walk you down. It wasn't far. Ryan immediately learned that he'd be sharing an office right here on the top floor. This came as a surprise. Getting to the 7th floor at Langley took years and often meant climbing over bloody bodies. Somebody, Jack speculated, must have thought he was smart. Simon Harding's office was not overly impressive. The two windows overlooked the upriver side of the building, mainly 2- and 3-story brick structures of indeterminate occupancy. Harding himself was crowding 40, pale and fair-haired with china-blue eyes. He wore an unbuttoned vest, waistcoat, locally, and a drab tie. His desk was covered with folders trimmed in striped tape, the universal coating for secret material. "You must be Sir John," Harding said, setting down his briar pipe. "The name's Jack," Ryan corrected him. "I'm really not allowed to pretend I'm a knight. Besides, I don't own a horse or a steel shirt." Jack shook hands with his workmate. Harding had small, bony hands, but those blue eyes looked smart. "Take good care of him, Simon." Sir Basil immediately took his leave. There was already a swivel chair in place at a suspiciously clean desk. Jack tried it out. The room was going to be a little crowded, but not too badly so. His desk phone had a scrambler under it for making secure calls. Ryan wondered if it worked as well as the STU he'd had at Langley. GCHQ out at Cheltenham worked closely with NSA, and maybe it was the same innards with a different plastic case. He'd have to keep reminding himself that he was in a foreign country. That ought not to be too hard, Ryan hoped. People did talk funny here. Grass, raspberry, and castle, for example, though the effect of American movies and global television was perverting the English language to the American version slowly but surely. "Did Baz talk to you about the Pope?" Simon asked. "Yeah. That letter could be a bombshell. He's wondering how Ivan's going to react to it." "We all are, Jack. You have any ideas?" "I just told your boss if Stalin was sitting there, he might want to shorten the Pope's life, but that would be a hell of a big gamble." The problem, I think, is that although they are rather collegial in their decision-making, Andropov is in the ascendancy, and he might be less reticent than the rest of them. Jack settled back into his chair. You know, my wife's friends at Hopkins flew over there a couple of years ago. Mikhail Suslov had diabetic retinopathy of the eyes. He was also a high myope, very nearsighted, and they went over to fix it, and to teach some Russian docs how to do the procedure. Kathy was just a resident then. But Bernie Katz was on the fly team. He's the director at Wilmer. Super eye surgeon, hell of a good guy. The agency interviewed him and the others after they came back. Ever see that document? There was interest in his eyes now. No. Is it any good? One of the things I've learned being married to a doc is that I listen to what she says about people. I damn sure listen to Bernie. It's worth reading. There's a universal tendency for people to talk straight to surgeons, and, like I said, docs are good for seeing things that most of us miss. They said Suslov was smart, courteous, businesslike, but underneath, he was the sort of guy you wouldn't trust with a gun in his hand. Or, more likely, a knife. He really didn't like the fact that he needed Americans to save his sight for him. It didn't tickle his fancy that no Russians were able to do what he needed done. On the other hand, they said that the hospitality was Olympic class once they did the job. So they're not complete barbarians, which Bernie halfway expected. He's Jewish. Family from Poland, back when it belonged to the Tsar, I think. Want me to have the agency send that one over? Harding waved a match over his pipe. Yes, I would like to see that. The Russians. They're a rum lot, you know. In some ways, wonderfully cultured. Russia is the last place in the world where a man can make a decent living as a poet. They revere their poets, and I rather admire that about them, but at the same time, you know, Stalin himself was reticent about going after artists. The writing sort, that is. I remember one chap who lived years longer than one would have expected. Even so, he eventually died in the gulag. So their civilization has its limits. You speak the language? I never learned it. The Brit analyst nodded. It can be a wonderful language for literature. Rather like Attic Greek. It lends itself to poetry, but it masks a capacity for barbarism that makes the blood run cold. They are a fairly predictable people in many ways, especially their political decisions within limits. Their unpredictability lies in playing off their inherent conservatism against their dogmatic political outlook. Our friend Suslov is seriously ill. Heart problems. From the diabetes, I suppose. But the chap behind him is Mikhail Yevgenievich Alexandrov, equal parts Russian and Marxist, with the morals of Lavrenti Beria. He bloody hates the West. I expect he counseled Suslov. They are old, old friends. To accept blindness rather than submit to American physicians. And if this Katz chap is Jewish, you said? That would not have helped either. Not an attractive chap at all. When Suslov departs, a few months, we think, he'll be the new ideologue on the Politburo. He will back Yuri Andreevich on anything he wishes to do, even if it means a physical attack on His Holiness. You really think it could go that far? Jack asked. Could it? Possibly, yes. Okay. Has this letter been sent to Langley? Harding nodded. Your local station chief came over to collect it today. I would expect your chaps have their own sources, but there's no sense taking chances. Agreed. You know, if Ivan does anything that extreme, there's going to be hell to pay. Perhaps so, but They do not see things in the same way we do, Jack. I know. Hard to make the full leap of imagination, however. It does take time, Simon agreed. Does reading their poetry help? Ryan wondered. He'd only seen a little of it, and only in translation, which was not how one read poetry. Harding shook his head. Not really. That's how some of them protest. The protests have to be sufficiently roundabout that the more obtuse of their readers can just enjoy the lyrical tribute to a particular girl's figure without noticing the cry for freedom of expression. There must be a whole section of KGB that analyzes the poems for the hidden political content, to which no one pays particular attention until the Politburo members notice that the sexual content is a little too explicit. They are a bunch of prudes, you know. How very odd of them to have that sort of morality and no other. Well, one can hardly knock them for disapproving Debbie Does Dallas, Ryan suggested. Harding nearly choked on his pipe smoke. Quite so. Not exactly King Lear, is it? They did produce Tolstoy, Chekhov, and Pasternak. Jack hadn't read any of them, but this didn't seem the time to admit to it. He said? Alexandrov asked. The outrage was predictable, but remarkably muted, Andropov thought. Perhaps he only raised his voice for a fuller audience, or more likely his subordinates over at the party secretariat building. Here is the letter, and the translation, the KGB chairman said, handing over the documents. The chief ideologue in waiting took the message forms and read them over slowly. He didn't want his rage to miss a single nuance. Andropov waited, lighting a Marlboro as he did so. His guest didn't touch the vodka that he'd poured, the chairman noted. This holy man grows ambitious, he said finally, sitting the papers down on the coffee table. I would agree with that, Yuri observed. Amazement in his voice. Does he feel invulnerable? Does he not know that there are consequences for such threats? My experts feel that his words are genuine, and no, they believe he does not fear the possible consequences. If martyrdom is what he wishes, perhaps we should accommodate him. The way his voice trailed off caused a chill even in Andropov's cold blood. It was time for a warning. The problem with ideologues was that their theories did not always take reality into proper account, a fact to which they were mostly blind. Mikhail Yevgenovich, such actions are not to be undertaken lightly. There could be political consequences. No, not great ones, Yuri. Not great ones, Alexandrov repeated himself. But yes, I agree. What we do in reply must be considered fully before we take the necessary action. What does Comrade Suslov think? Have you consulted him? Misha is very ill, Alexandrov replied, without any great show of regret. That surprised Andropov. His guest owed much to his ailing senior, but these ideologues lived in their own little circumscribed world. I fear his life is coming to its end. That part was not a surprise. You only had to look at him at the Politburo meetings. Soslov had the desperate look you saw on the face of a man who knew that his time was running out. He wanted to make the world right before he departed from it, but he also knew that such an act was beyond his capacity, a fact that had come to him as an unwelcome surprise. Did he finally grasp the reality that Marxism-Leninism was a false path? Andropov had come to that conclusion about 5 years before. But that wasn't the sort of thing one talked about in the Kremlin, was it? And not with Alexandrov, either. He has been a good comrade these many years, If what you say is true. He will be sorely missed, the KGB chairman noted soberly, genuflecting to the altar of Marxist theory and its dying priest. That is so, Alexandrov agreed, playing his role as his host did, as all Politburo members did, because it was expected, because it was necessary, not because it was true, or even approximately so. Like his guest, Yuri Vladimirovich believed not because he believed, but because what he purported to believe was the source of the real thing. Power. What, the chairman wondered, would this man say next? Andropov needed him, and Alexandrov needed him as well, perhaps even more. Mikhail Yevgenievich did not have the personal power needed to become General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. He was respected for his theoretical knowledge, his devotion to the state religion that Marxism-Leninism had become, but no one who sat around the table thought him a proper candidate for leadership. But his support would be vital to whoever did have that ambition. As in medieval times, when the eldest son became the lord of the manor, and the second son became the bishop of the attendant diocese, so Alexandrov, like Suslov in his time, had to provide the spiritual, was that the proper word, justification for the ascension to power. The system of checks and balances remained, just more perversely than before. You will, of course, take his place when the time comes, Andropov offered as the promise of an alliance. Alexandrov demurred, of course, or pretended to. There are many good men in the party secretariat. The chairman of the Committee for State Security waved his hand dismissively. You are the most senior and the most trusted, which Alexandrov well knew. You are kind to say so, Yuri. So, what will we do about this foolish poll? And that, so baldly stated, would be the cost of the alliance. To get Alexandrov's support for the general secretaryship, Andropov would have to make the ideologue's blanket a little thicker by, well, by doing something he was already thinking about anyway. That was painless, wasn't it? The KGB chairman adopted a clinical, business-like tone of voice. Misha, to undertake an operation of this sort is not a trivial or a simple exercise. It must be planned very carefully, prepared with the greatest caution and thoroughness, and then the Politburo must approve it with open eyes. You must have something in mind? I have many things in mind, but a daydream is not a plan. To move forward requires some in-depth thinking and planning, merely to see if such a thing is possible. One cautious step at a time, Andropov warned. Even then, there are no guarantees or promises to be made. This is not something for a movie production. The real world, Misha, is complex. It was as close as he could come to telling Alexandrov not to stray too far from his sandbox of theories and toys and into the real world of blood and consequences. Well, you are a good party man. You know what the stakes in this game are. With those words, Alexandrov told his host what was expected by the secretariat. For Mikhail Yevgenievich, the party and its beliefs were the state, and the KGB was the sword and shield of the party. Oddly, Andropov realized, this Polish pope surely felt the same about his beliefs and his view of the world. But those beliefs weren't, strictly speaking, an ideology, were they? Well, for these purposes they might as well be, Yuri Vladimirovich told himself. My people will look at this carefully. We cannot do the impossible, Misha, but... But what is impossible for this agency of the Soviet state? A rhetorical question with a bloody answer. And a dangerous one. More dangerous than this academician realized. How alike they were, the KGB chairman realized. This one, comfortably sipping his brown starka, believed absolutely in an ideology which could not be proven. And he desired the death of a man who also believed things that could not be proved. What a curious state of affairs. A battle of ideas, both sets of which feared the other. Feared? What did Carol fear? Not death, certainly. His letter to Warsaw proclaimed that without words. Indeed, he cried aloud for death. He sought martyrship. Why would a man seek that? The chairman wondered briefly. To use his life or death as a weapon against his enemy. Surely he regarded both Russia and communism as enemies, one for nationalistic reasons, the other for reasons of his religious conviction. But did he fear that enemy? No. Probably not, Yuri Vladimirovich admitted to himself. That made his task harder. His was an agency that needed fear to get its way. Fear was its source of power, and a man lacking fear was a man he could not manipulate. But those whom he could not manipulate could always be killed. Who, after all, remembered much about Leon Trotsky? Few things are truly impossible. Merely difficult, the chairman belatedly agreed. So, you will look into the possibilities? He nodded cautiously. Yes, starting in the morning. And so, the processes began. Chapter 3. Explorations. Well, Jack's got his desk in London, Greer told his colleagues on the 7th floor. Glad to hear it, Bob Ritter observed. Think he knows what to do with it? Bob, what is it with you and Ryan? The DDI asked. Your fair-haired boy is moving up the ladder too fast. He's gonna fall off someday, and it's gonna be a mess. You want me to turn him into just one more ordinary desk weenie? James Greer had often enough fended off Ritter's beefs about the size and consequent power of the intelligence directorate. You have some burgeoning stars in your shop, too. This kid's got possibilities, and I'm gonna let him run until he hits the wall. Yeah, I can hear the splat now, the DDO grumbled. Okay, which one of the crown jewels does he want to hand over to our British cousins? Nothing much. The appraisal of Mikhail Suslov that the doctors up at Johns Hopkins did when they flew over to fix his eyes. They don't have that already? Judge Moore asked. It wasn't as though it were a super-sensitive document. I guess they never asked. Hell, Suslov won't be around much longer anyway, from what we've been seeing. The CIA had many ways to determine the health of senior Soviet officials. The most commonly used was photographs, or better yet, motion picture coverage of the people in question. The agency employed physicians, most often full professors at major medical schools, to look at the photos and diagnose their ills without getting within 4,000 miles of them. It wasn't good medicine, but it was better than nothing. Also, the American ambassador, every time he went into the Kremlin, came back to the embassy and dictated his impressions of everything he saw, however small and insignificant it might seem. Often enough, people had lobbied for putting a physician in the post of ambassador, but it had never happened. More often, direct DO operations had been aimed at collecting urine samples of important foreign statesmen, since urine was a good diagnostic source of information. It made for some unusual plumbing arrangements at Blair House, across the street from the White House, where foreign dignitaries were often quartered, plus the odd attempt to break into doctors' offices all over the world. And gossip, There was always gossip, especially over there. All of this came from the fact that a man's health played a role in his thinking and decision-making. All three men in this office had joked about hiring a gypsy or two, and observed, rightly, that it would have produced results no less accurate than they got from well-paid professional intelligence officers. At Fort Meade, Maryland, was yet another operation, codenamed Stargate, where the agency employed people who were well to the left of gypsies. It had been started mainly because the Soviets also employed such people. "How sick is he?" Moore asked. "From what I saw 3 days ago, he won't make Christmas. Acute coronary insufficiency, they say. We have a shot of him popping what looks like a nitroglycerin pill." "Not a good sign for Red Mike," James Greer concluded with Suslov's in-house nickname. "And Alexandrov replaces him?" "Some bargain," Ritter observed tersely. "I think the gypsies switched them at birth. Another true believer in the great god Marx."
"We can't all be Baptists, Robert," Arthur Moore pointed out.
"This came in 2 hours ago on the secure fax from London," Greer said, passing the sheets around. He'd saved the best for last.
"Might be important," the DDI added.
Bob Ritter was a multilingual speed reader.
"Jesus."
Judge Moore took his time. As a judge should, he thought. About 20 seconds later than the DDO, my goodness. A pause.
"Nothing about this from our sources?"
Ritter shifted in his chair.
"Takes time, Arthur, and the Foleys are still settling in."
"I presume we'll hear about this from Cardinal."
They didn't often invoke that agent's code name. In the pantheon of CIA crown jewels, he was the Cullinan Diamond.
"We should, if Ustinov talks about it, as I expect he will. If they do something about it..."
"Will they, gentlemen?" the DCI asked.
"They'll sure as hell think about it," Ritter opined at once.
It's a big step to take, Greer thought more soberly. You suppose His Holiness is courting it? Not too many men walk up to the tiger, open the cage door, and then make faces at him.
I'll have to show this to the President tomorrow.
Moore paused for a moment's thought. His weekly meeting at the White House was set for 10 o'clock on the following morning.
The papal nuncio is out of town, isn't he?
It turned out that the others didn't know.
He'd have to have that one checked out.
What would you say to him anyway?
This was Ritter.
You have to figure that the other guys in Rome tried to talk him out of this.
James? Kinda takes us back to Nero, doesn't it? It's almost as though he's threatening the Russians with his own death.
Damn. Do people really think that way?
40 years ago, you put your life on the line, James.
Greer had served his time on fleet boats in the Second World War, and often wore a miniature of his gold dolphins on the lapel of his suit coat.
Arthur, I took my chances, along with everybody else on the boat. I did not tell Toja where I was in a personal letter.
The man has some serious cojones, guys, Ritter breathed. We have seen this sort of thing before. Dr. King never took a step back in his life, did he?
And I suppose the KKK was as dangerous to him as the KGB is to the Pope, Moore completed the thought. Men of the cloth have a different way of looking at the world. It's called virtue, I think.
He sat forward.
Okay. When the President asks me about this, and for damn sure he will, what the hell do I tell him?
Our Russian friends might just decide that His Holiness has lived long enough, Ritter answered.
That's a hell of a big and dangerous step to take, Greer objected. Not the sort of thing a committee does.
This committee might, the DDO told the DDI.
There would be hell to pay, Bob.
They know that. These men are chess players, not gamblers.
This letter backs them into a corner.
Ritter turned.
Judge, I think the Pope's life might be in danger.
It's much too early to say that, Greer objected. Not when you remember who's running KGB. Andropov is a party man. What loyalty he has is to that institution, damn sure not to anything we would recognize as a principle. If this frightens or merely worries them, they will think about it. The Pope has hurled down his gauntlet at their feet, gentlemen, the deputy director, operations, told the others. They just might pick it up. Has any Pope ever done this? Moore asked. Resign his post? Not that I can remember, Greer admitted. I don't even know if there's a mechanism for this. I grant you, it's one hell of a gesture. We have to assume he means it. I don't see this as a bluff. No, Judge Moore agreed. It can't be that. He's loyal to his people. He has to be. He was a parish priest once upon a time. He's christened babies, officiated at weddings. He knows these people, not as an amorphous mass. He's been there to baptize and bury them. They are his people. He probably thinks of all Poland as his own parish. Will he be loyal to them, even at the peril of his life? How can he not be? Ritter leaned forward. It's not just a question of personal courage. If he doesn't do it, the Catholic Church loses face. No, guys, he's serious as hell, and he isn't bluffing. Question is, what the hell can we do about it? Warn the Russians off? Moore wondered aloud. No chance, Ritter shot back. You know better than that, Arthur. If they set up an operation, it'll have more cutouts than anything the Mafia's ever done. How good do you suppose security is around him? Not a clue, the DCI admitted. But I know the Swiss guards exist with their pretty uniforms and pikes. Didn't they fight once? I think so, Greer observed. Somebody tried to kill him, and they fought a rearguard action while he skipped town. Most of them got killed, I think. Now they mostly pose for pictures and tell people where the bathroom is, probably, Ritter thought out loud. But there has to be something to what they do. The Pope is too prominent a figure not to attract the odd nutcase. The Vatican is technically a sovereign state. It has to have some of the mechanisms of a country. I suppose we could warn them. Only when we have something to warn them about. Which we don't have, do we? Greer pointed out. He knew when he sent this off that he'd be rattling a few cages. What protection he does have must be alerted already. This will get the president's attention, too. He's going to want to know more, and he's going to want options. Jesus, people, ever since he made that evil empire speech, there's been trouble across the river. If they really do something, even if we can't pin it on them, he's going to erupt like Mount St. Helens. There's damn near 100 million Catholics right here in America, and a lot of them voted for him. For his part, James Greer wondered how far out of control this might spin. Gentlemen, all we have to this point is a fax of a photocopy of a letter delivered to the government in Warsaw. We do not know for certain that it's gone to Moscow yet. We have no sign of any reaction to this from Moscow. Now, we can't tell the Russians we know about it, so we can't warn them off. We can't tip our hand in any way. We can't tell the Pope that we are concerned for the same reason. If Ivan's going to react, hopefully one of Bob's people will get us the word, and the Vatican has its own intelligence service, and we know that's pretty good. So for the moment, all we have is an interesting bit of information that is probably true, but even that is not yet confirmed. So for the moment, you think we just sit on this and think it through? Moore asked. There's nothing else we can do, Arthur. Ivan won't act very fast. He never does. Not on something with this degree of political import. Bob? Yeah, you're probably right, the DDI agreed. Still, the president needs to hear about it. It's a little thin for that, Greer cautioned. But yes, I suppose so. Mainly, he knew that not telling the president and then having something dire happen would cause all of them to seek new employment. If it goes further in Moscow, we ought to hear about it before anything drastic happens. Fine. I can tell him that, Judge Moore agreed. Mr. President, we are taking a very close look at this. That sort of thing usually worked. Moore rang his secretary and asked for some coffee to be sent in. Tomorrow at 10, they'd brief the president in the Oval Office, and then after lunch would be his weekly sit-down with the chiefs of the other services, DIA and NSA, to see what interesting things they had happening. The order should have been reversed, but that's just how things were usually scheduled. His first day at work had lingered quite a bit longer than expected before he'd been able to leave. Ed Foley was impressed by the Moscow Metro. The decorator must have been the same madman who'd designed Moscow State University's wedding cake stonework. Evidently beloved of Joe Stalin, whose personal aesthetic had run the gamut from Y to Z. It was strangely reminiscent of the Tsarist palaces, as interpreted by a terminal alcoholic. That said, the metro was superbly engineered, if somewhat clunky. More to the point, the crush of people was very agreeable to the spook. Making a brush pass or other sort of pickup from an agent would not be overly trying, so long as he kept to his training. And that was something Edward Francis Foley was good at. Mary Pat would love it here, he was sure now. The milieu for her would be like Disney World was for Eddie. The crush of people, all speaking Russian. His Russian was pretty good. Hers was literary, having learned it at her grandfather's knee, though she'd have to detune it, lest she be made as someone whose language skills were a little too good to be merely the wife of a minor embassy official. The subway worked well for him. With one station only a couple of blocks from the embassy and the other practically at their apartment house's doorstep, even the most paranoid Directorate II shadow would not find his use of it terribly suspicious, despite the well-known American love for cars. He didn't look around any more than a tourist would and thought that maybe he'd made one tail. There'd probably be more than that for the moment. He was a new embassy employee, and the Russians would want to see if he wiggled like a CIA spook. He decided to act like an innocent American abroad, which might or might not be the same thing to them. It depended on how experienced his current shadow was, and there was no telling that. For certain, he'd have a tail for a couple weeks. That was an expected annoyance. So would Mary Pat. So probably would Eddie. The Soviets were a paranoid bunch, but then he could hardly complain about that, could he? Not hardly. It was his job to crack into the deepest secrets of their country. He was the new chief of station, but he was supposed to be a stealthy one. This was one of Bob Ritter's new and more creative ideas. Typically, the identity of the boss spook in an embassy wasn't expected to be a secret. Sooner or later, everyone got burned one way or another, either ID'd by a false flag operation or through an operational error, and that was like losing one's virginity. Once gone, it never came back. But the agency only rarely used a husband-wife team in the field, and he'd spent years building his cover. A graduate of New York's Fordham University, Ed Foley had been recruited fairly young, vetted by an FBI background check, and then gone to work for the New York Times as a reporter on a general beat. He'd turned in a few interesting stories, but not too many, and had eventually been told that while the Times wasn't going to fire him, it might be better for him to seek employment with a smaller newspaper, where he might blossom better on his own. He'd taken the hint and gotten the job with the State Department as a press attaché, a job that paid a decent bureaucratic wage, though without a supergrade's destiny. His official job at the embassy would be to schmooze the elite foreign correspondents of the great American papers and TV networks, granting them access to the ambassador and other embassy officials, and then keeping out of the way while they filed their important stories. His most important job was to appear competent, but little more. Already the local Times correspondent was telling his colleagues that Foley hadn't had the right stuff to make it big as a journalist at America's foremost newspaper, and since he wasn't old enough to teach yet, the other resting place for incompetent reporters, he was doing the next worst thing, being a government puke. It was his job to foster that arrogance, knowing that the KGB would have its people ping on the American press corps for their evaluation of the embassy personnel. The best cover of all for a spook was to be regarded as dull and dim, because the dull and the dim weren't smart enough to be spies. For that, he thanked Ian Fleming and the movies he'd inspired. James Bond was a clever boy, not Ed Foley. No, Ed Foley was a functionary. The crazy part was that the Soviets, whose entire country was governed by dull functionaries, more often than not fell for this story just as readily as if they were someone fresh off the pig farm in Iowa. There was nothing predictable about the espionage business, except here, the station chief told himself. The one thing you could depend on with the Russians was predictability. Everything was written down in some huge book, and everybody here played the game by the book. Foley got aboard the subway car, looking around at his fellow passengers, seeing how they looked at him. His clothing marked him as a foreigner as clearly as a glowing halo marked a saint in a Renaissance painting. "Who are you?" a neutral voice asked, rather to Foley's surprise. "Excuse me," Foley replied in badly accented Russian. "Ah, you are American." "Da, that is so. I work at American Embassy. My first day. I am new in Moscow." Shadow or not, he knew that the only sensible thing was to play this straight. "How do you like it here?" the inquisitor asked. He looked like a bureaucrat. Maybe a KGB counter-espionage spook or a stringer. Or maybe just some officer-sitter for some government-run business who suffered from curiosity. There were some of those. Would an ordinary citizen approach him? Probably not, Foley judged. The atmosphere tended to limit curiosity to the space between a person's ears. Except that Russians were curious as hell about Americans of every stripe. Told to disdain or even to hate Americans, the Russians frequently regarded them as Eve had regarded the apple. "The metro is very impressive," Foley answered, looking around as artlessly as he could. "Where in America do you come from?" was the next question. "New York City." "You play ice hockey in America?" "Oh, yes. I've been a fan of the New York Rangers since I was a child. I want to see the hockey here." Which was entirely truthful. The Russian skate-and-pass game was the closest thing to Mozart in the world of sports. "The embassy has good tickets," they told me today. "Central Army," he added. "Bah," the Muscovite snorted. "I am Wings fan." The guy might just be genuine, Foley thought with surprise. The Russians were as picky about their hockey clubs as American baseball fans were with their home teams. But the second chief directorate probably had hockey fans working there, too. Too careful was a concept he did not admit to, especially here. "Central Army is the champion team, isn't it?" "Too prissy. Look what happened to them in America." "In America, we play a more physical, is that the right word, game. To you, they must seem like hooligans, yes?" Foley had taken the train to Philadelphia to see that game. The Flyers, more widely known as the Broad Street Bullies, had beaten the snot out of the somewhat arrogant Russian visitors, rather to his amusement. The Philadelphia team had even wheeled out its secret weapon, the aging Kate Smith singing God Bless America, which for that team was like breakfasting on nails and human infants. Damn, what a game that one had been. They play roughly, yes, but they are not fairies. Central Army thinks they are the Bolshoi, the way they skate and pass. It's good to see them humbled sometimes. Well, I remember the 80 Olympics, but honestly, that was a miracle for us to defeat your fine team. Miracle? Bah! Our coach was asleep. Our heroes were asleep. Your children played a spirited game, and they won honestly. The coach needed to be shot. Yeah, this guy talked like a fan. Well, I want my son to learn hockey over here. How old is he? Genuine interest in the man's eyes. 4 and a half, Foley answered. A good age to learn to skate. There are many opportunities for children to skate in Moscow, aren't there, Vanya? He observed to the man next to him, who'd watched the exchange with a mixture of curiosity and unease. Make sure he gets good skates, the other man said. Bad ones can injure the ankles. A typical Russian response. In this often harsh country, solicitude for children was endearingly genuine. The Russian bear had a soft heart for kids, but one of icy granite for adults. Thank you. I will be sure to do that. You live in the foreigner's compound? Correct, Foley confirmed. Next stop is yours. Oh, spasibo, and good day to you. He made his way to the door, turning to nod a friendly goodbye to his newfound Russian friends. KGB, he wondered. Perhaps, but not certainly. He'd determine that by whether or not he saw them on the train a month or so from now. What Ed Foley didn't know was that the entire exchange had been observed by a man a mere 2 meters away, holding a copy of today's Sovietsky Sport. His name was Oleg Zaitsev, and Oleg Ivanovich was KGB. The station chief left the subway car and followed the crush to the escalator. At one time, it would have led him to a full standing portrait of Stalin. But that was gone now, and not replaced. The outside air was acquiring the early autumn chill, just enough to feel good after the stuffiness of the metro. Around him, 10 or more men lit up their foul-smelling cigarettes and walked their separate ways. It was only half a block to the walled compound of apartment blocks, with its guard shack and the uniformed attendant, who looked Foley over and decided he was an American by the quality of his overcoat, without acknowledging his passage by even a nod, and certainly not a smile. The Russians didn't smile much. It was something that struck all American visitors to the country. The outwardly dour nature of the Russian people seemed almost inexplicable to foreigners. 2 stops further down, Oleg Zaitsev wondered if he should write up a contact report. KGB officers were encouraged to do so, partly as a sign of loyalty, partly to show their eternal vigilance against citizens of the main enemy, as America was known within his professional community. It was mostly to show their institutional paranoia, a characteristic openly fostered by KGB. But by profession, Zaitsev was a paper pusher, and he didn't feel the need to generate more meaningless paper. It would just be looked at, read in a cursory way at most, and tossed into some file box by some other bureaucrat from his upstairs office, never to be read again. His time was too precious for that sort of nonsense. Besides, he hadn't even talked to the foreigner, had he? He left the train at the proper stop, rode up the moving stairs into the crisp evening air, lighting his Trude cigarette as he got outside. It was a vile thing. He had access to the closed stores and could have bought French, British, or even American smokes, but they were too costly, and his funds were not as unlimited as his choices. So he smoked the well-known Labor brand, like untold millions of his countrymen. The quality of his clothing was a tiny bit better than that worn by most of his comrades, but not overly so. Not so much that he stood out from the others. It was 2 blocks to his apartment building. His flat was number 3 on the first. The Americans would have called it the second floor instead of higher up, and that was fine with him because it meant that he didn't risk a heart attack if the elevator didn't work, which happened about once a month. Today, it worked. The elderly woman who occupied the janitor superintendent's flat on the ground floor had her door closed today instead of open to denote some mechanical problem she'd have to warn him about. So nothing in the building was broken today. Not quite cause for celebration, just one of the small things in life for which to be grateful to God, or whoever determined the vagaries of fate. The cigarette died as he walked in the main door. Zaitsev flicked the butt into the ashtray and walked to the elevator, which remarkably was waiting for him, with the door open.
"Good evening, Comrade Zaitsev," the operator said in greeting.
"Good evening, Comrade Glenko."
The man was a disabled veteran of the Great Patriotic War, with the medals to prove it. Artilleryman, so he said. Probably the building informer. The man who reported unusual occurrences to some other KGB stringer, in return for which he got a niggardly stipend to supplement whatever pension the Red Army paid him. That was the extent of their exchange. Glenko turned the handle and brought the elevator car smoothly to his floor and opened the door. From there it was a mere 5 meters to his home. Opening his apartment door, he was greeted by the smell of boiling cabbage. So, cabbage soup for dinner. Not unusual. It was a staple of the Russian diet, along with rich black bread.
"Papa!"
Oleg Ivanovich bent down to scoop up his little Svetlana. She was the light of Zaitsev's life, with her cherubic face and welcoming smile.
"How is my little Zaitchik today?"
He scooped her up in his arms and accepted her darling little kiss. Svetlana attended a daycare center crowded with other children her age. Not quite a preschool, not quite a nursery. Her clothing comprised about the only colorful things to be had in his country, in this case a green pullover shirt and gray pants over little red leather shoes. If his access to the closed shops had one advantage, it was in what he could get his little girl. The Soviet Union didn't even have cloth diapers for its infants. Mothers usually made them out of old bedsheets, much less the disposable kind favored in the West. As a result, there was a premium on getting the little one's toilet trained, which little Svetlana had managed some time ago, much to her mother's relief. Oleg followed the smell of cabbage to his wife in the kitchen.
"Hello, darling," Irina Bogdanova said from the stove.
Cabbage, potatoes, and what he hoped was some ham cooking. Tea and bread. No vodka yet. The Zaitsevs drank, but not to excess. They usually waited until Svetlana went down to bed. Irina worked as an accountant at the gum department store. The possessor of a degree from Moscow State University, she was liberated in the Western sense, but not emancipated. Hanging by the kitchen table was the string bag she carried in her purse everywhere she went, eyes always on the lookout for something she might buy to eat or brighten their drab flat. It meant standing in line, which was the task of women in the Soviet Union, along with cooking dinner for her man, regardless of his professional status in life or hers. She knew that he worked for state security, but did not know his job there, just that it paid a fairly comfortable salary, and came with a uniform that he rarely wore, and a rank soon to take a jump upward. So whatever he did it well enough, she judged, and that was sufficient. The daughter of an infantryman in the Great Patriotic War, she'd gone to state schools and gotten above-average marks, but never quite achieved what she'd wished. She'd shown some talent at the piano, but not enough to go onward to a state conservatory. She'd also tried her hand at writing, but there, too, she'd fallen short of the necessary talent to get published. Not an unattractive woman, she was thin by Russian standards.